Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome. Once again, it's Progressive News Network. I'm your host and news director, Rick Spezak. I've got some fantastic talent on tonight. We've got Dennis Campbell, author of Vagina Wars. We've also got James Goodall, former attorney for the New York Times. He protected them during the Pentagon Papers case, and he talks about Pentagon Papers case versus WikiLeaks. And that's some really good information we want you to enjoy. A couple of other things I want to mention real quick. Don't forget to listen to our colleagues on Progressive Radio. I'm talking about our good friends Gwen from Here Be Monsters, Amy Tidd, Susan Nylon, also Brian Stetton, Anita Gee. Make sure you tune into these shows. They're great. The links are on our site. Also want to mention that selective guests are available online. You can listen to them anytime. Also, of course, this show is live, but also we have the ability to, you can download podcasts in the future. Also, by the way, Martin County, not normally known as a really progressive county, elected three very progressive women to our caucus, to the state party. That's right. That's the It's a Jungle Out There theme. Okay, there we go. And so without any further ado, let's go ahead and listen to Dennis Campbell, part one. Here we go, Dennis. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce Dennis Campbell, editor of the UK Progressive magazine and author of many, many books. Dennis, welcome, sir.
Welcome. Thank you. Glad to be here.
I understand that you are weighing in on this whole right-wing attack on women's rights and women's issues. You've got a new book.
Yes, I do. It's called The Vagina Wars, GOP's War on Women. And it came out about a week ago, a little over a week ago. We're in day number 8, I think, of it. And it's still in the top 5 on the Kindle Politics list. And we seem to have struck a bit of a nerve. I was looking at the whole situation of how unprecedented the attacks have been, particularly in the last quarter of 2011 and the first quarter of this year. It seems like you could not pick up a newspaper or a news story anywhere without seeing this coordinated attack. And lo and behold, one of the last bits of information I loaded into the book just before it went up online was the revelation that Alec had sponsored something like 944 pieces of legislation from January to the end of March in this first quarter. And in 45 separate states, all aimed at women's reproductive rights. So I got, as a father of three daughters and a grandfather of a granddaughter, very upset with the fact that we were back litigating things that we had talked about in the 60s and 70s.
You know, the last time contraception was a serious legislative issue was back when Margaret Sanger was fighting the battle, and condoms were illegal at the turn of the last century. And it beggars the imagination as to why the Republicans think this is a winning strategy to up the ante from being anti-abortion to being anti-contraception. The whole Rush Limbaugh scheme, which he's doubling down on as well. He's had another attack on this fine young woman who's dared to express an opinion. Well, what's your take on that situation?
Well, it appears to be, you know, a complete co-opting of the party by their very extreme Christian fundamentalist right wing. And, you know, I would be satisfied if they were just going after abortion because that's a white-hot issue, and I understand that. But when you start to move into contraception and you start to mess with curriculums and say that the only acceptable form of sex education is abstinence only, when you start to ban hormonal birth control pills, which are, you know, not only a right, but they're also used in a number of medical conditions by women. When you start to go down this path, it's such a slippery slope. You begin to wonder, you know, are they crazy? Well, no, maybe they're not crazy. I think they're really just trying to get as far to the right on as many issues as they can, so that when we drift back to the center, it has moved so far to the right that it looks even more conservative than where we started. And I think that's a little bit of what we're seeing here. But I just could not tolerate watching this attack on, you know, the basic fundamental rights of a woman to be a woman. And I'm very, very angry, and I think most men, good men of conscience, should be very angry with what the government is supposedly doing in, quote, our name. And I don't see that as anything that I could ever support.
Well, you know, there's been a deafening silence out of the White House, but there's something else I want to get at. And, you know, I mean, I hate to mention the H word of hypocrisy, but I wonder just how cynical this whole thing is. We've seen so much of the right wing make a feign or a pose in one direction when, in fact, their behavior is something else entirely. You're talking to people in Florida where the legislature censured a congressman for using the word uterus on the floor of the Florida legislature. I mean, they're banning science. They don't want to use biologically accurate words. I think, you know, your use of vagina wars would fly in the face of the Florida legislature, so to speak.
It would fly in the face of everybody, and I suppose I should explain a little bit as to why I chose that title. I moved to Europe in 1998, towards the middle part of 1998, and was fortunate enough to have taken a trip a couple of years before to New York City, where I saw this amazing off-Broadway play by Eve Ensler called The Vagina Monologues. So the title is really an homage to that fantastic play, which talks about women's issues in a way in which they'd never been addressed before, and really in a largely uncomfortable way for many people, but in a very important way. And you saw, for the generation at that time, a much-needed explanation, because the right wing has been so successful. Yeah, one of the things that I'm very upset about is that we've seen such a dumbing down of science, such a dumbing down of anything related to historical view of where the world is, that we will let the right wing get away with just about anything regarding sex education. We're almost to the point where now the only acceptable method for so many people, because they know no other way or no other information, is to go back to Foster Freeze putting an aspirin between your knees. It's an insane system, and having spent 15 years now almost in Europe, I look at it and I say, gosh, why can't we be a lot more open in the discussion of something that is a natural part of life, that is extremely important for our young people to understand? I mean, I have an older daughter who's in her mid-20s, but I also have two daughters that are entering puberty and teenage. I want them to know all of the risk factors that are out there. I want them to feel free to be able to come to their mother or to me and say, what happens in this particular instance? I want to make certain that the HPV virus is available for them. I want to make certain that if they choose they want to have a relationship that becomes sexual, that they're able to get, you know, anti-conception pills, all of which is doable in this part of the world. When I first moved to the Netherlands, which is where we lived for 6 years before we moved here, we were sitting at the dinner table with a lovely couple in The Hague and their daughters, who were in their mid-teens. They were probably 15 or 16 years of age. And there was a very frank and open discussion that, for me as a newly arrived American, was one in which my jaw hit the table for most of it. But afterwards, I was able to sit around the table with them and say, my goodness, this is not a conversation we could have had in my household growing up, or in any household in the United States, yet it was an open, honest, frank discussion about sex and relationships. And I thought, wow, that's really cool that these kids were secure enough with their parents to be able to have that kind of an open dialogue. I don't know about you, Rick, but when I was a kid, you know, the way we learned was the way, you know, everybody else learned. You learned from your pals on the street, and everybody that was bragging about it the most was doing it the least, and you were scared to death. And you found yourself in a situation where if someone had we actually gravitated to people who would give us the straight skinny, and they were few and far between. And now we're as a legislative body, as a nation, as a government, advocating that there be no discussion whatsoever, that you simply rely on abstinence pledges and, you know, don't talk to me about it, go ask your mother, and your mother says go ask your father, and the kid walks away so confused, yet hormones are bursting all over. They take these very public pledges, and of course the minute those hormones start to kick in, they're wondering, well, gosh, why can't I follow those hormones and do what feels right at that time? So in the state of Mississippi, which has some of the most restrictive legislation out there on reproduction and sex and whatever, you have the highest teen pregnancy rate and the highest consumption of pornography. And it makes no sense to me.
Well, you know, unfortunately, those proponents of ignorance, those proponents of a state of human ignorance, to see college being sneered at, to see knowledge being avoided. When you talk about candor, when you talk about the fact that, you know, the whole revolution of the 60s in America, where we decided we were going to dispense, at least part of the culture decided to dispense with all these foolish words and speak bluntly, speak simply, use scientific language, speak frankly to our children. There are those people in this culture who never bought that, who never agreed to that. And I think this is we're kind of seeing the revenge of the anti-60s people, and that, you know, they've got the reins of power and they want to ban frank discussion. They want to see science banned from the schools. They didn't like science in the first place. You know, they want to hug their ignorance to their bosom. And it's just a shame. I think that your title is, in its frankness, in its simple openness, is very refreshing, and I want to salute you for it.
Thank you. I had one woman say to me, she said, gee, thank goodness it's an e-book, because I don't think I could walk through the stacks of the local bookstore with a book with the B word on the cover. So I do give hats off to her for her honesty. But the fact is that, you know, as advanced as we like to think we are in the United States, we actually have very Victorian, very prurient views of the way in which sex should be handled and discussed and talked about. It's just not something you discuss. And, you know, the nice thing about living here in socialist Europe is that you, you find yourself where people actually want to have discussions about things. I mean, when I tell my wife that, another state is thinking about going back to evolution-based,
creationism.
Yeah, thank you. The teachings, I think, no, the Republican Party is not just trying to take everybody back to the 1940s. They want to go back to the 1920s and disprove the Scopes monkey trial, for God's
sake. Sure.
And it's just, it is beyond, the fact that creationism is considered a science now in so many school districts is absolutely frightening. And what I see happening here in the UK, for example, is that it's starting to creep into some of the church school curriculums as a point of discussion. And we're also seeing protests beginning to happen, US-style protests outside of abortion clinics in central London. And you say to yourself, wait a minute, we've got too much that's making its way across the pond that is this sort of negative, conservative, biased, even people in London, when they see these protests, they're saying, what the hell is going on? I mean, it's not the way we do things here.
Well,
so,
one of the things I was going to say is, you know, it strikes me as beyond ironic that when somebody, for example, when they chastise Representative Randolph for using the word uterus on the floor, he was making a joke. He was saying that, you know, since Republicans don't like to restrict businesses, maybe he should incorporate his wife's uterus. And that's what they took exception to, because they don't like to regulate businesses, so therefore maybe if her uterus was an incorporation, then maybe they'd leave it alone, for God's sakes. And so he was chastised for it. But what it ended up causing, and this is the beauty of that kind of stupidity, was they ended up, it became a campaign. We were wearing uterus buttons. They made up soft plush toys, uteruses, and gave them to people. People were having their picture taken with uteruses. And it's you know, the kind of the perfect antidote to that kind of stupidity. Like you, I have daughters. I have a wonderful wife. I had a wonderful mother and wonderful grandmother. And to see women disrespected so badly by, you know, what you have to regard as, like it or not, I mean, this is a powerful influence in this godforsaken country. And it's remarkable. And I can't think that they're that stupid. I have to think this is a cynical attempt to, again, use fear, use these scare tactics, you know, since they had to up the ante. I just wonder where the heck they're going next.
Well, that's a very good question, and one that if you look at the history of the legislation that they've tried to pass, if you look at the history of how far to the right the conservative movement is trying to push everything, I think the goal is they know the jig is just about up. They know that there's a very good chance that they're likely to be, if not turned aside, severely weakened in the upcoming election. Let's push everything as far to the right as we can. I mean, I was watching the Maddow podcast this morning about what's going on in Michigan, and what a coincidence. Everything was dated for all of the acts that they wanted to have take effect the day before the resolution would have taken place, stopping the law in its track. I mean, they are absolutely devious and sinister in every way, and that's not the political world in which we grew up. I mean, the fact that everything is so bitterly polarized that there is no middle ground left anywhere, and that whatever middle ground is there has been pushed further and further and further to the right. This is, I think, considered a victory by them. We'll go as far to the right as we possibly can, and then when we're drifted back to the center, at least that center will have shifted so far to the right, we're getting closer and closer to our objective.
Well, that was part one of the interview with Dennis Campbell. By the way, you can go to Amazon to buy his ebook, Vagina Wars. And now we'll go on to part two.
One of the things I never liked about the Republican Party was the deviousness, particularly this is not my father's Republican Party, because I actually respected that party, but the deviousness over the last 10 or so years in which they don't go after an issue head on. They attack it around the corners and make it impossible. I used to do a lot of writing for poker magazines, and I used to contribute regular regulatory columns back during the time that the Uniform Internet Gaming Enforcement Act came out. And that basically, everybody says, banned online gambling. Well, no, it didn't. You can still gamble online. They didn't go after gambling because they don't have the guts to go after gambling. What they did was they went after the federal payment processing system, and they said it's illegal for you to process any winnings through the federal processing system. So the end result, the effect, was to make it an illegal thing to do, but gambling is still perfectly legal. Same thing with the abortion thing. We're never going to go after Roe v. Wade, but what we're going to do is we're going to put a lot of trap laws in place. We're going to put a lot of conscience laws in place. We're going to make you have to go through so many health and safety hoops and whistles that it's going to be impossible for you to do what is your legal right to do, because you can't keep the clinic open, because you can't follow the rules. And the deviousness of it all is something that has just happened in the last 10 to 15 years. And that's the part of it that I think needs people to speak up. Because I mean, you've got campaign adverts out there that are blatantly lying, and nobody, there's no authority, either the FCC or the FEC, that has the guts to stand up and say, stop doing that, it's against the law, and here's the fine, or here's what's going to happen. They don't care. They're just going to do it anyways, even if it's wrong and it's a lie.
Well, part of my own pen is a comic pen, and the fodder for political satire on this is amazing. And when I heard of a Virginia legislator who said, okay, okay, this is what you want to do to women, well then fine. If you want Viagra, then you should get a proctology exam. And you had to admire them. I just wish they'd followed through and really made it a cross-country issue the way they'd these fools have done this with the abortion. I am old enough to remember pre-Roe v. Wade, as I'm sure you are as well. And my own mother lost a friend who was forced to find an illegal solution, mm-hmm. and it cost her life. And whenever the question comes up of will you stand with women, will you stand for the human rights of women and their choices, I have to say yes. I say yes for her. I say yes for my mother. I say yes for my wife and my daughters and whatever granddaughters I might have, because this is unconscionable in a civilized society that women are being put upon this way. I have asked for years why we never finished the battle getting women equal pay. I think that battle's been put aside for far too long. But this is beyond words. It is tremendous, and it has to be fought. And I salute you for your book, Vagina Wars. Before we go further into the book, why don't you tell our audience where they can find it?
Yeah, it's I've done an exclusive with Amazon, and most people that are of the progressive bent say, "Oh God, Amazon! Well, I don't want to support them," and I do apologize for that. It is though a good platform for getting out into multiple countries quickly with a very, very strong message. And if you don't want to purchase a Kindle, which I also understand, they do right on the page where you can find the book. Again, it's The Vagina Wars, the GOP's War on Women. They have a space on the right-hand side where you can actually get a Kindle reader. And, for example, I read all my e-books on my iPad via the Kindle reader, and it's been very, very helpful. After 3 months and the exclusivity deal is over, I'll put it up on Nook and some of the other platforms, but we really wanted this to become a big campaign issue, and frankly, we're very heartened by the response that we've had so far. I mean, this morning it was again at number 5. It's a long hike to get up over Politico and their power at number 4, but you know, to be the behind the 2 political e-books and Game Change, you know, is pretty heady stuff as far as we're concerned, and we're very, very grateful that so many people are understanding how important this message is and important to get out.
Well, let me ask you a question. As you were doing your research on this, were you able to find a Romney position on this?
No, not at all. I mean,
what was I thinking? Romney.
Not even just find a Romney position, just find one Romney position, because as we know, I mean, he, and the interesting thing now is that if you look at the campaign, they recognize that you cannot win the election with a double-digit difference in the way in which women view you, and I think that's fabulous. I also, one of the things that really bothered me, and I make a bit of a deal of it in the book, is I want people to understand something that's not talked about a lot, and that's the impact of a Romney presidency on the Supreme Court. We have 4 justices now of the Supreme Court that are in their mid-70s, mid to late 70s. And, you know, 2 of them are conservative, but 2 of them are also some of the liberal icons, and including Justice Ginsburg. And so when I looked at that, there's the very real prospect that despite everybody before having 1 or 2, and President Obama has appointed 2 very strong members to the bench, we could see in this next 4-year presidency 4 Supreme Court justices appointed by a conservative president if Romney were to win. I don't know about you, but that prospect absolutely is the most frightening prospect of a Romney presidency, that you go from being just 5-4 to perhaps being as big as 6-3 or 7-2 conservative. And, you know, if you look at the likes of people that are there now with Scalia and Thomas, forget about women's rights, forget about individual rights, corporations will rule, and there'll be absolutely nothing to stop. So I'm very, very concerned about that, and I talk about that in a chapter of the book. The other issue that very much concerns me is, you know, the access overall to health care. If I look at what the Ryan budget has in plan, and if I look at what all of these pieces of legislation have planned, it's going to be absolutely devastating. If you think things are bad in Texas right now, for example, they're going to be 10 times worse in the next 6 months as a lot of the cuts start to kick in. And there's just this fundamental unfairness, and this is why we need to make huge changes, both to bring in a Democratic Congress, or else we're going to find ourselves even further behind with more wars and more interventions in other parts of the world, and you know, the U.S. still being the world's policeman.
With the a large number of Republican enthusiasts, they'd just as soon see somebody die without health care as to help them. Now, that seems the preferable situation. And also, they have no problem with more wars. And, you know, I had the good fortune to hear Scalia speak at an ACLU conference in D.C. a few years back. And he made the same point that you just made a moment ago. He said, you know, just wait until we get a few more conservatives up here. You're going to see some real conservative decisions then. And, I mean, the crowd literally gasped.
Yeah.
Let's go back to your book.
Sure.
When you raise this issue, do you see this coming from something? I mean, how do you see the genesis of this whole attack on women? What do you think was the motivating factor for it? Simple opportunism
No, interestingly, the motivation and the genesis of all this is a very real demographic time bomb that is exploding in the United States, in which traditional white males are becoming a shrinking percentage of the population. And I make a lot of connections both here but in my earlier book about the Egyptian Revolution, Egypt Unshackled, to the impact of demographics over time, and that is the one wave nobody can ignore. Mubarak did so at his peril. He ignored the fact that, you know, yes, he was in his 80s and 70s, and most of the generals are in their 70s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. They control all of the wealth, but the average population of Egypt is 29. Well, we're seeing a similar situation happening in the United States, but not in terms of age, in terms of the, you know, the fact that women now make up 53% of the population and the growing number of Hispanics that are there. And I wrote an article back in November on UK Progressive, my magazine, in which I said, I honestly can see with Romney as the nominee a path to 400 electoral votes for Barack Obama. And at the time, Gingrich was very strong. And if Newt Gingrich is the nominee, 500 electoral votes, because the South would be the biggest impact. They would actually lose several of the more moderate southern states, and they would lose the West altogether. And I laid out the case for that in terms of what had happened in 2008, what was likely to happen in 2012. And it was only based on one thing, demographics. And the fact that, you know, unless, of course, the economy completely craters and tanks between now and November, and, you know, we find ourselves engaged in a war in Iran, it's pretty much a cakewalk for President Obama, but we do need every progressive out there voting for him. The worst thing we can do is sit back on our hands and think we've got this one in the bag. The second worst thing we can do is believe all of the conservative pundits, because one of the statistics I saw just yesterday was there's something like 4,600 hours of cable news television time that has to be filled from the 1st of May till the end of October. So you know they're going to do anything they can to create controversy, a meme, or whatever, because their financial well-being is all based upon the ability to gin up a controversy, so people have to spend a lot of money on adverts, and there'll be billions of dollars out there to be spent, so they're going to do everything they can to get their fair share of it.
Well, that's for sure. You know, with Olympia Snowe and a few other moderate Republicans leaving, certainly it bodes ill for anything like the old honorable Republican moderate. I remember Lowell Weicker, I'm sure you do as well. And even William Buckley, for all his excesses, he was always prepared to entertain a rational argument, a fair, equitable discourse, and at least listen to the other side. And what we seem to be seeing in the Republican legislature is clearly people who have no interest in a rational discussion.
No. And the interesting thing about that, taking it to its conclusion, I mean, my senator was Edward Brooke and Teddy Kennedy. And you could not ask for two more different people. but they knew how to work together for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts back when I was a kid, and they knew how to, you know, when to fight and when not to. One of the favorite things, I can't remember whose memoir it was, whether it was Tip O'Neill's or Ronald Reagan's, you know, when it came to legislation, they fought like cats and dogs. And the way they could tell they probably had done the right thing was if both ended up hating the final result. That's what compromise looked like. I mean, I've been doing stories on Iraq Camp Ashraf, which is sort of stepping into a hornet's nest, because in the UK and in the EU, the group that they represent, the MEK, are no longer a terrorist organization. In the US, they are. So you've got six or seven governments, the United Nations, everybody else involved in this, but the pawns were these 3,400 people that were sitting in the middle of the desert. And the way I knew I had a pretty good story was if I found myself with the folks in the Iranian propaganda ministry very upset with me, and if I also had the MEK upset with me saying I wasn't going far enough, I usually knew I'd hit the ball pretty much straight down the middle. And this is what's missing in U.S. government right now, is this ability to find that middle ground and to compromise and to work together to find solutions. Everybody gets more and more entrenched. And as we lose Blue Dog Democrats and moderate Republicans like Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins and others, it only gets worse. Congress gets even more unmanageable than it is today. And issues like women's issues and issues that I wrote about in the book become even more critical going forward.
Do you think there's a direct relationship between this war on women and the, let's just say, the modest undertaking of providing some health care for Americans in general?
Well, I'm a big supporter of single-payer systems because I've been in one for 15 years.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I absolutely adore the National Health Service. And I get very angry when I see people attack the UK NHS or any other system in Europe, because they're not essentially profit-based system; they're care-based systems. And what, you know, what happens in a care-based system is that, yes, sometimes you have to wait. But I got to tell you, when my retina detached 5 years ago, and I was walked into the casualty unit, emergency room, you know, they immediately rushed me up, and two other people who were there for elective surgery that day got bumped, so my eyesight could be restored. And somebody comes to you and says, "I'm sorry, but we had to bump you because we had an emergency coming," and they explain the situation, I'm going to be the last person to complain. I think we have this interesting dilemma in the States in that everybody feels entitled to be first in line. And, you know, yes, you can be first in line, but then get a supplemental insurance policy and go to a private doctor to be first in line, so you don't, you know, end up being, you know, have to wait in a queue. Everybody else is pretty much satisfied by saying, okay, you know what, it's elective. The more acute, right to the front you go. The more elective, yeah, you may have to wait a few weeks for it before you actually get seen. And the system works. You walk into casualty, you walk out, nobody's signing forms, there's nobody there to, there's no cashier, there's no billing office, there's nothing. I mean, you even walk out with a bag, paper bag, satchel filled with the medicines that you need, you know, to get you through the next 10 days. I mean, I just find it, you know, a much more civilized system than to find myself and listen to my colleagues saying that, you know, birth control pills that I can remember were $12 a month back in whenever it was, you know, now cost $3,000 a year. That's $500 a month, now we're $250 a month. It just seems insane amount of money, and it's all built around the fact that, you know, the United States have to pay for subsidies of drugs that are picked up by other governments, and, well, too bad. It should all be subsidized at some level.
Let's go back to this war on women. Obviously, beyond scaring the paranoid, it seems that there's so little to be gained. The GOP has run hard against immigrants. They've run hard against women. You know, by pushing further and further to the right, the only logical electoral reaction one must assume is that they're going to be limiting and limiting and limiting those who might appeal to them. The only potential gain is that they make anybody who's even a moderate look like an extremist. And I was wondering, if you play this out past the election, do you see this GOP war on women continuing? Do you think this is going to be a real continued thrust of the GOP?
I think it has the potential to do so. I mean, you're about to have another wave election, and hopefully that will gain control of some of the state legislatures back, or at least bring some balance in. 2010 was an abomination of an election, not just what happened in the U.S. Congress, but what happened in state houses across the United States. When you cede total control to one party, as you've seen happen in Wisconsin and in Michigan and in Florida and other states, it creates this environment where they say, hey, I'm a business person. I was a business person when I started. If you're Governor Scott or if you're Governor Walker or whatever, let's get what we can through to make certain that our nest is feathered, so that when or if we get kicked out, we've got ourselves, you know, a good situation going forward. I don't think that will ever be allowed to happen to that extent again. I think voters now understand. I hope voters understand, you know, the dangers of allowing one party to take complete and total control like that. That said, it's like looking at, the old story about the turtle and the scorpion. The turtle wants to cross the river, and the scorpion says, put me on your back. And the turtle says, no, I won't do that. You're going to sting me, and then we'll die. And, you know, the scorpion says, no, I won't do that. We'll get across. Halfway across the river, you know, the scorpion stings the turtle, and they both sink. And as they're sinking, the turtle says, why did you do that, knowing we're both going to drown here? And the scorpion says, I just couldn't help myself. Well, this is the situation you have, and they have got to reach out and lash out and sting. And I don't know you're ever going to change that, you know, fundamental nature of how the right acts. Even if they know it's bad, they're going to try it anyways. The thing is that when they tried it in the past, they were able to do it because the left just sort of sat back and let them do it. Now there's people like you, there's people like me, there's people all over the blogosphere and all over the media that are demanding accountability, and it's no longer the cakewalk that it used to be for them. They actually are being called to account by people like Maddow and Lawrence and Ed and others, and it's nice to see. And we need to keep doing that because the right is well-funded. I mean, all their bloggers are paid millions by a variety of sources. None of us are paid millions. Hopefully we'll get to a point where, you know, that does happen. And we've got to keep the fight going because, I mean, this is for our daughters. This is for our granddaughters. And when I look at, you know, these pieces of legislation, I got angry. I don't think I've been this angry in quite some time when I read some of the pieces of legislation that I read in putting this book together. And, you know, Governor Vaginal Probe up in Virginia and others, because they have this right-wing Christian theological bent to the way in which they go about governing their states or their commonwealths. And you say to yourself, that's just insane. You've got to, as a representative of the people, represent all the people, not just the Christians or not just, the John Birch Society or not just, you know, the group of corporations and businesses that put you there.
Well, I salute you. Let me ask you this. Who do you see as the audience for this book? Is this to analyze the situation? Is this a suggestions, a how-to guide to change things? How would you characterize the book?
I would characterize it as a primer that gives them an idea of what the extent of what is going on, because a lot of people probably don't have the wonkish level of detail that I do. And I want to always contextualize anything I write into a this is what this means to you and why you should be upset. I see this book as a call to arms. I see this book as a call to action. We cannot allow, for example, what John McCain is doing this week, which is attempting to change the narrative and whitewash away the last 6 months of attacking women as if it never happened. We can't allow the GOP to be a perfectly tuned weather vane, which was the words used by John Huntsman to describe Mitt Romney. We cannot allow them to just keep shifting in the wind and get away with it. They'll get away with it with the base, and there's no way any of us are going to be able to convince our crazy Tea Party uncle, so don't even try. Focus your efforts on the people with the brain, the independents that will decide this election, and just continually show them all of the ways in which the right is trying to whittle away at their rights. And even if they seem to think they're okay, point out to them, you know, that it's going to take 12 to 18 months to find a job if you were to lose your job today, for example. And what are you going to do? You may be all right now, but there's not a single person in a job anywhere in the United States that cannot be eliminated like that tomorrow. And they need to understand that there is no safety net out there for them if they're earning above a certain amount, and that safety net that's there is fraying and is about to fall to the ground, and that these attacks on women just cannot be allowed to stand.
Well, Dennis, I want to thank you so much for this excellent interview. I want to congratulate you on the book, and I wish you every success, sir.
Thank you, Rick. It's been a pleasure.
You have a very good day, sir. Bye-bye. Okay. Awesome.
That work?
And there we go. Next up, we've got James Goodale, former attorney for the New York Times. He was attorney for the Times during the famous Pentagon Papers incident. And he's going to address a comparison between the Pentagon Papers and the issues that they raised and the issues raised by WikiLeaks. And he's going to weigh in with his perspective on, are these comparable? And I want to thank our line producer, Jay, for getting this recording for us. This was a live speech, a presentation at Indian River State College in Fort Pierce. And here we go, James Goodale.
Our topic today surely shares that commonality, and we all have much to learn about the issues WikiLeaks has raised. Our speaker is a preeminent First Amendment lawyer. He is also a teacher, a commentator, and a keeper of the flame. Indeed, he was a key figure in designing the concept of First Amendment jurisprudence. Had James Goodale been there in Philadelphia in 1787 for the Constitutional Convention, he would have heard, with, I think, considerable discomfort. General George Washington, president of the convention, declaring in his opening remarks, quote, "Gentlemen, we will have no newspaper reporters attending our discussions, and the delegates will not talk to the press, because if you do, you will not be willing to change your minds on the issues, nor will you be willing to speak frankly in front of reporters," end quote. I paraphrase only slightly. That was his message, and he enforced it. The press was a player from the beginning, and it had been for more than a century during the colonial period in the form of small circulation newspapers. Mr. Goodale came along a little later. He graduated from Yale Law School in the late 1950s, spent a few years at Lord Day and Lord, the law firm representing the New York Times, and then in 1963, he joined the Times itself as its only in-house lawyer. In short order, he built a legal department, eventually became an executive VP and vice chairman of the company, and helped take the family-owned New York Times public. He also was intimately involved in the four cases that brought the New York Times before the Supreme Court. The first was New York Times versus Sullivan, which dealt with libel. The second, in 1971, was the Pentagon Papers case, which dealt with prior consent, or you could say censorship. On the Pentagon Papers case, the court ruled 6-3 in favor of the Times and the First Amendment, and Mr. Goodale had arrived. He He seems never to have looked back. In 1980, he moved to Debevoise, Clifton, taking the Times with him as his client. And over the years, he's also represented the Hearst Corporation, NBC, Cablevision, Channel 13, public television, and take note, the NFL, NHL, and NBA, football, hockey, and basketball. Who needs tickets? James Goodale is also a prolific writer of articles and books, mostly on the press. And since 1977, he has been on the faculties of many law schools, Yale, NYU, New York Law, and Fordham, among them. From 1995 to 2010, he produced and hosted his own public television show called The Digital Age, not surprisingly. In all, using many platforms, Mr. Goodale has taught hundreds and hundreds of lawyers how to practice First Amendment law, and he has encouraged them to do so with the example of his own remarkable career. Let me conclude by pointing out that James Goodale played varsity baseball and hockey as an undergraduate. He's often unreachable these days because he keeps in shape ice skating in New York's Central Park. Hockey, I might add, is good preparation for the WikiLeaks debate, which begins, as they say on cable television, right now. Ladies and gentlemen, James Goodale.
Thank you all for coming. This is the first time I've been here. This is just one great campus, one great college, one great faculty, and if I've met more undergraduates, or any, in fact, I would say great undergraduates, which I'm sure is the case. Thanks a lot for having me. I think probably Stanley's remarks about my ice skating proclivities, for those of you who live in this climate, probably falls on deaf ears. I hope that my talk on Julian Assange does not fall on deaf ears, because it's about to break again, he's about to be in the news again, and it's for me a very exciting time. Now, you heard all the mention of law cases, law this and law that. I want to use this occasion to tell you of a story of Julian Assange, because I think that many of the threads of the story have been lost, and I think it'd be fun to sort of see what it was all about, what it's about today, and then we can get to the First Amendment question, which, if you can guess, you probably can guess what my answer is. Okay, let's start off with WikiLeaks. Now, if I slip into Wikipedia, it's only because I use Wikipedia all the time. If I say Wikimedia, that's because what I think the media has come. But all of you know what Wiki means, at least you should. Which is that if you go on Wikipedia, for example, you are part of the process. You are able to create and make whatever comes out on Wikipedia. And Wikipedia, and WikiLeaks, which is formed by Julian Assange, you can do the same thing. He has a website that is a receptacle for information from people who wish to leak secret information. It is there to keep the identity of the person who leaks the information secret. When it started, the leaker could participate on what was on the website. That has changed. Now, the website is just there for Julian Assange. Who is Julian Assange? Well, Julian Assange was an Australian who moved to Europe to start WikiLeaks, which is a website technically. It is located in Sweden because Sweden has very good laws that protect sources of those who give information to WikiLeaks. He started in 2006 with WikiLeaks. In the first years of WikiLeaks, we didn't hear very much about it. In the years 2007, 8, and 9, he was starting up. He ran some information that was quite important, He ran information about elections that influenced election in Kenya. He ran information about those who had died during the Iraq War. That number had never previously been disclosed. He ran information about a nuclear mishap in Iran. Those were his major contributions for the 3 years in question. He hit the big time in 2010. He hit the big time because he met through some process, we'll get back to exactly how he met the gentleman I'm about to describe to you, Private Manning. Private Manning was in the Intelligence Corps of the United States Army, and he had access to secret documents, mostly secret, not top secret. Now, what Manning did was he took the secret documents, he downloaded, you all download, you know what that means. They were encrypted when they first came to Manning. He would decrypt them and then put the decrypted material in a receptacle effectively, which made him able to deliver it to people who would have interest in what he had. The first such decrypted email, I think, in fact, is what it was, involved a shooting of a Reuters reporter by a helicopter in Iraq. And this hit the headlines. But that was little compared to what was to come. In the balance of 2010, he released information about Afghanistan and information about the diplomatic cables that he had access to. With respect to the information that he released about Afghanistan, they became known as the Afghanistan warlords. This is how he did it. He had all the information that Manning had given. It came in encrypted form. He decrypted it. He sent it to Assange. Now, what Assange did thereafter was different than what he'd done before. What he did at that point was he got in touch with Der Spiegel, that's a German newspaper, the New York Times, and the Guardian, that's an English newspaper. And he said, hey guys, look, I've got material that you would have a great interest in with respect to Afghanistan and with respect to diplomatic cables. Those two events were actually separated, but I'm putting them together for ease of conversation. I want you to look at them and see if you want to release them. You make your own decision with respect to what you're going to do. And once you've made your decision, then I'll decide what to do. So, what those three newspapers did was they released the information that, with respect to the Afghan warlords and to the diplomatic cables, all at the same time. And then once that information had been released, then Assange released it. Now, what was in the Afghan warlords? I have to tell you, Assange has released so much material, thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of email, that the truth of the matter is no one knows exactly what is released. What we know is what we can take the time to find on the net, or what we know is from the reports in the newspapers to which I describe. Here's generally, without going into any great detail, what the Afghan logs told us. They told us that Pakistan was heavily involved in the Afghan war. This came as a shocker. We didn't know it at the time. We know it today, don't we? But we didn't know it at the time. They told us that the drones that were put in place to get terrorists, after all, Al-Qaeda, were being used in a domestic war in Afghanistan. They told us that there was a death squad of U.S. Soldiers, NATO soldiers, that went around and killed suspected terrorists in Afghanistan. We didn't know that. With respect to the diplomatic cables were of a different sort. I must say there are millions and millions of these diplomatic cables. You couldn't read them all if you tried. What the diplomatic cables described pretty much was the daily life of what went on in diplomats when they're in countries. They serve. The diplomats send back information about the countries to Washington, D.C. These cables are not particularly offensive in my view, not shared by everybody, but in my view, they would say such things as the Canadians have an inferiority complex. Saudi Arabia, we want you to attack Iraq, a little more serious, but not that serious when you stop to think about it. The Chinese are behind breaking into the computers in the United States, a little bit more serious, but not as serious. Some other things you can think of. More importantly, with respect to Tunisia and with respect to Libya, they describe the activities of the people who govern those two countries and describe them in no flattering terms whatsoever, and very unflattering terms. What was the impact of each of these? Take the diplomatic cables first. Diplomatic cables are thought to have played a major role in the Arab Spring, particularly in Tunisia and particularly in Libya. Everyone was so shocked as to what was being said about the leaders of those two countries, disclosing information that people hadn't had before. It energized them to start the Arab Spring. That's a very important result. The other impact of the diplomatic cables, with all due respect, does not seem to be that earth-shaking with respect to its impact on national security. Not held by everybody. When the Afghan cables came out, by comparison, the Secretary of Defense was quite concerned that the Afghan cables would disclose sources for whatever military actions that were going to take place, and he was very unhappy about it. When the diplomatic cables came out, the Secretary of Defense took an entirely different approach. He said, I think they're harmless. Interesting. But Senator Joe Lieberman, did not think they were so harmless. He said the New York Times, The Guardian, and Der Spiegel have blood on their hands. What he did was, he then got in touch with PayPal and with MasterCard and the other credit companies that were supporting Julian Assange. By taking contributions for Julian Assange, he was a charitable group, a nonprofit group, and people wished to support him. We used PayPal and MasterCard, and he turned off a lot of the money that went to Julian Assange. Now, we're going to see effectively what the impact of all of that is on what happened to Julian Assange thereafter, and to Private Bradley Manning. Here's what happened there. Okay, so now the law comes to play. Bradley Manning is in the Army. He's subject to Army discipline and Army laws, military laws. Julian Assange is not. Bradley Manning was immediately arrested. He was charged under the Uniform Code of Military Justice for aiding and abetting the enemy. He was charged under the Espionage Act and the Computer Act. I'll tell you a little bit about the Espionage Act in a second. With respect to Julian Assange, and here the tale gets a little bit more murky because he's in and out of the courts and you don't know exactly what's happening to him. I'm going to tell you in a few minutes something's about to happen to him, which makes all of what I have to say even more important than perhaps I think it is. With respect to Julian Assange, the first thing that happened to him was he was charged in Sweden for inappropriate sexual behavior. And I don't think I'll go into the details. It was a fleet of attack. And that charge was carried over to England, where Julian Assange was presently residing. He was asked by the Swedish authorities, with respect to that charge, to be extradited from the UK to Sweden. Now, so what, you might say? Well, as I will tell you in a few minutes, there's a U.S. connection to all of this. In any event, he was then tried, or his case was heard in a trial court in the UK. Should he be extradited or not? He said, I shouldn't be extradited because you know what's going to happen to me? I'm going to be extradited to Sweden. As soon as I get to Sweden, Sweden's going to ship me off to the United States, and that'll be the end of me. I'll end up in Guantanamo. He lost. He appealed the case. He lost. He appealed the case to the Supreme Court of the UK in February. That court has now had the case for a couple of months. All of us who have followed the case think that they're going to come down, that court's going to come down with a decision pretty quickly. In other words, let's say in the next 30 or 40 days. And when that happens, the fat will be in the fire with respect to Julian Assange and to what ultimately happens to him. I think, and others who have looked at the case believe, that the British court will indeed send him back to Sweden. When he gets back to Sweden, and this may happen in the next 30 or 60 days, all hell will break loose because Assange's lawyers will get up and say, I can't be extradited because I'm a political prisoner and hear my case and keep me in Sweden. We'll see if indeed that happens. Now, the other thing that happened, we talked about Bradley Manning here in the U.S., and we talked about Assange in the UK, and we've talked about Swedish courts and what they might do, is that in the United States, when WikiLeaks came out, and after Senator Joe Lieberman said, the New York Times and everyone else had blood on their hands, what happened was that the United States government, this would be President Obama and the Attorney General, Mr. Holder, put into place a grand jury to indict Assange. And so there is sitting now in Virginia a grand jury that is ready to indict Assange once Assange comes into this country. If that grand jury indicts Assange, then we're going to have the case of the century under the First Amendment, and that's what I'm here to talk about in some part today. You've got to understand why this grand jury was put in place. There's some obvious reasons which I've already discussed, but one reason that you may not have appreciated is that President Obama is, from a press point of view, the worst national security president the press has ever known. I'm an Obama supporter, and it pains me to tell you that. But he is a national security hawk. That's quite popular. Perhaps he should be a national security hawk. He said that he's going to run for presidency on his national security record, perhaps as a national security hawk. He has indicted more leakers during his term of presidency than has any other president in the United States. History. History. And I'll tell you why indicting and using the criminal process for leaking is a little unusual in just one second. But the numbers go something like this. In the previous history of the United States, before the Pentagon Papers case. Now, I was in the Pentagon Papers case. I'm going to tell you something about it later. And so when I say those magic words, you know, I think everyone knows all about it. But when it happened, I have students in law school. They don't know all about it. They particularly don't know when it happened. But anyway, when it happened, I like to say when things happened in the in my era, that it happened in the last century, almost the middle of the last century, not quite, in 1971. At the time of 1971, when Danny and I'll talk more about him later, leaked the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times. There had never been a prosecution for leaking. I'll tell you why in a minute. But leaks just took place. People lived with them. No one had a nervous breakdown over them. And they were sort of part of the way you did things in Washington. So much information was classified. People in the ordinary course would tell my friend Stanley Flank, did you hear about this and that and the other thing? And it turned out that this, that, and the other thing would be classified. Perhaps Stanley Flank would know about it, perhaps he wouldn't. But there was just tons of leaking that went on before 1971 and to this day. Do you know today there are 4 million people who have access to classified information? 4 million people. That's an awful lot of people to access to classified information and not expect that somehow something's going to leak out from them to the press. Obama, in his first year of his presidency, classified 77 million documents. Now, how in the world can there be 77 million documents that have classified information that is necessary to be retained by the government in them? It's improbable. In Bush's last year, he had classified 44 million documents. So my point about Obama is that he is a national security hawk with respect to classification. Now, I said that until the Pentagon Papers, there had been no indictments of people who leaked. Ellsberg, who was the leaker, he was indicted. He got off, so to speak, because Nixon had broken into his private office, and the court hearing this case said, I don't want to hear it. After that, before Obama came in, there were 2 other instances of indictments for leaking. Now, President Obama has indicted 6 or 7 people for leaking in the 3-plus years he's had the presidency. And with that background, it makes me worry a little bit what's going to happen down the line with Assange. Now, why is it that we had not had indictments for leaks in the past? As I've indicated in the past, because it was part of the normal conversation that takes place in Washington, D.C. When I made that statement in making previous talks of this sort, I look out at the audience, and the audience usually doesn't believe me. In fact, when I first started this field, I didn't believe it either. But the fact of the matter is, there's so much information, as I said before, that subject to classification, it leaks out, it's inevitable, and it's necessary. I'll come back to that point. Now, there is no law that says you can't leak, or if you were to receive a leak, that you can be prosecuted for it. There's no law as such. What there is a law called the Espionage Act. The Espionage Act, believe it or not, covers espionage. That's rather tough. Espionage. It doesn't cover leaks. Now, the Espionage Act was used in the Pentagon Papers case to stop the New York Times from publishing the Pentagon Papers. More about that in a minute. But the Espionage Act, all it says is if you communicate information relating to the national defense to the enemy with an intent to harm the United States, you can be put in the can for espionage. Makes sense. If you are subject to the rules of classification, that is to say, you can look at classification material, you've been authorized to do it, you obviously cannot take that information and run over to the Russians or the Iraqis or the Iranians, say, here it is. That is espionage. But leaking is not espionage. Leaking is part of the conversation the governor has with the press, and it's for the purposes of informing the public. So that is why we have not had any prosecutions under the Espionage Act. Okay, a little water, we'll get back to this one.
Okay, that was the end of part one. Before I go on to part two, I want to make a couple brief announcements. PDA, Progressive Democrats for America, are looking for people to call, to make phone calls for them. Please contact Mike Fox. Many of you know Mike. Mike Fox, that would be PinellasPDA@yahoo.com. Let Mike know you heard about it on the show. They need help getting progressives elected. All you need to do is make a few phone calls. It will be a big help. Also, the FCC, Prometheus Radio Project, is looking for people to send notes to the FCC, that's the Federal Communications Commission, on behalf of community radio. If you believe in community radio, if you believe in progressive radio, community radio that serves the community, not international conglomerate radio, contact the Prometheus Radio Project. They need people to send quick little notes. Also, again, I want to congratulate three progressive women activists from the Martin County area elected to the state convention as delegates. That'd be Patricia Metro-Patrick, Tara Woodruff, and our own hardworking DPCF sister, Denise White. These are great women, all active progressives, and now they're going to be serving and making our voice, progressive voice, heard at the party level. And now, part two of James Goodale on the WikiLeaks and the Pentagon Papers.
Let's talk about the First Amendment for a moment. In just ordinary terms, not fancy legal stuff, but just ordinary terms, because all of us, ever since grade school, have known about the First Amendment. The First Amendment says that Congress shall make no laws that shall abridge freedom of speech and or the press. So, we all know that. But what does it really mean? It means that we protect speech. It protects what I am saying now. It protects what you say to one another as you leave this room. It protects what you say on your email. It protects the transmission of information over the airwaves. We can't have the government stop programs that people see on TV. We can't have the government come in and cut off Internet access, which is what some countries try to do. Iran and Iraq have tried to shut down their internet systems. Our government can't shut down our systems. So it protects speech in all sorts of forms. It's not just speaking like I'm speaking to you. It includes speaking digitally. Okay, now, the next question. Can I say anything I want? Can I say anything I want on the internet? Can I say anything I want anytime? There is an exception to the First Amendment, which you all heard too, which is that you can't shout fire in a crowded theater. You probably heard that in grade school if you've forgotten. What the sense of it is that if you are in a crowded theater and you shout fire and there ain't no fire, pandemonium is going to break loose. You cannot incite people to cause a commotion. There's a limitation on the speech that you are permitted to make. All right, now, how does that limitation fit into what we're talking about today? There is a limitation on free speech with respect to national security matters. Now, how does that work? Let me tell you how it works in the context of the Pentagon Papers case. Now, that case is a highly dramatic one. If you think about history and go back into the middle of the last century and think about Richard Nixon, he was then president. And one of the things he did, which he shouldn't have done, was trying to stop the New York Times from publishing the Pentagon Papers. The reason he shouldn't have done it is that once he did it, a series of events took place thereafter, which were closely linked, that led to his downfall in Watergate. Why do I say that? Because the band of plumbers, quotes he used, those to break into Ellsberg's office, I told you Ellsberg's office was broken into, were discovered, and one thing led to another, and Nixon was out. So what did he try to do in the Pentagon Papers case? The Pentagon Papers were, in a sense, like WikiLeaks. Tons and tons of papers. They were wheeled into my office in 8 or 10 shopping carts. And what were they? They were the history of the Vietnam War. From starting in 1946, when hostilities really began, up to 1968. And each volume set out what happened. Daniel Ellsberg, they were all classified. So, they were classified. All the papers that Assange had were classified. The papers that were classified described cables, same cables that were in Assange. They described materials that were allegedly coded. They weren't, but allegedly were. Basically, when you stop to think about it, it was no more than a history that you buy in a history book. But it was all based on secret documents. And it provided, in a sense, the full story of Vietnam, which you couldn't get. And that's pretty much the same as Assange. Although there's so much stuff that Assange gets put out, you can't get what really was going on in Afghanistan until you read the material that he distributed. Daniel Ellsberg was working for a consultant for the United States. He looked at this stuff, and he was very angry. And he was an expert in this subject. Surprising he was so angry. But when he read it all, it just made him think, if I could just get this out to the American public, the American public will understand that the Vietnam War is not worth anything. And I suppose you could say that was the same with respect to Assange, with respect to the Afghan War. There were good reasons for starting the Afghan War, but in my humble opinion, I think the majority of Americans would agree with me, there are better reasons for stopping it as quickly as we can. And I think that was Ellsberg's view of the Pentagon Papers. He delivered them to the New York Times. They were rolled into my office. They were then distilled into articles. And think about the comparison of that to Assange. Assange had a great big batch of material. He delivered it to the New York Times and Guardian. They distilled what he had and put it out. Ellsberg took a great big batch of documents. He gave them to the New York Times. The New York Times distilled them, and they were published. When they were published, all hell broke loose. Nixon came in and stopped the Times from publishing. The case went to the Supreme Court. Now, to come back to my point of shouting fire in a crowded theater, the Supreme Court said the First Amendment applies to these materials, even though they are classified. The classification stamp means nothing as far as we are concerned as Supreme Court justices. If the government wants to put a classified stamp on its material so that it informs the people who work for the government that this is important stuff, that does not mean that when it leaks out, we have to take as granted that it is important. We will apply our own standard because the First Amendment applies. And that standard is the First Amendment permits publication unless you get into the exception. Now, what's the exception? But the exception is another term that perhaps you remember from grade school. It is a form of clear and present danger. Unless the publication causes a clear and present danger to the security of the United States. You can go forward with publication. There was no way the Pentagon Papers, which covered a history that began in 1946 and that ended in 1968, could cause a clear and present danger. It was a history. I mean, how can a history, take a history book from one of your courses, put it up on the internet, for example? It's not going to cause a clear and present danger to the United States. Okay, so what the Pentagon Papers is, when you stop to think about it, it's Assange all over again, using Assange with little quotes around the name. Now let's see if we can get the cast of characters straight with respect to Assange and compare that with the Pentagon Papers. Now, in the Pentagon Papers, we have Daniel Ellsberg. He's working for a consultant to the United States, RAND Corporation. He comes across these documents of history that have a classification stamp on it. He picks them up, then using the technology of the day, I saw this fabulous technology center you have here today. I could spend hours there. Well, technology is extremely important here today at this college. It's extremely important to all of us as we live in the digital age. But hey, it was important back, way back then, because the technology of the day that provided copies was the Xerox machine. Does anyone remember the Xerox machine? Well, let me tell you, the Xerox machine was a big deal in the lives of us denizens of the last century. When I first went to a law firm and I had to copy papers, I used an Osler machine. That's all we had to copy. The trouble with an Osler machine was when you put the papers you had on top of a radiator, it took all the ink off. So when the Xerox machine came along, it was terrific for lawyers, but also terrific for Daniel Ellsberg because he could copy all the papers. And so he copied them, gave them to the New York Times to a reporter called Neil Sheehan. And the rest is history with respect to the Pentagon Papers. Now, let's think about that and apply that to Julian Assange. Most people, when they think about WikiLeaks, I would say probably first get angry. Secondly, would even reach the level of Joe Lieberman's anger, that there's blood on the hands of those that have the papers. But guess what? Assange is not Ellsberg. See, Private Bradley Manning is Ellsberg. Private Manning is now sitting with a computer and digital communication and not the Xerox machine that Dan Ellsberg had. He, Manning, takes these digital communications. He's not delivering copies anymore. We're in the digital age now. We're in a college that has a great digital educational facility. And so Manning, as I suppose anyone else who wants to communicate information to others, uses the internet digitally. He sends a digital signal to Julian Assange. Julian Assange, now who's Julian Assange in our story? Well, here's the thing what most people don't need, and it's a central part of my message here today. When Julian Assange gets this material, we're now in the digital age, he really is the New York Times. Why is Julian Assange the New York Times? Because Julian Assange has the ability to publish, as indeed every single person in the room has an ability to publish. You have a website, or you email to put it on someone else's website, that's publication. Now think about what happened with respect to the Afghan and the diplomatic cables. They were sent to the New York Times, which published them on their website. Then Assange published the same things on his website. The two are the same. Very important to realize that. Now, people say, gee, Julian Assange, what, he's not doing anything, just sitting there as a conduit. Well, I want to
He did not release all the material that he had. He still has material about the Afghan war horse. He doesn't have any more material about the diplomatic cables because someone got his password and all the stuff was put out. But he's basically performing what we would say is a journalistic function. He's acting as a publisher who decides what to publish, what not to publish, which uses the means available to him under the new technology to get information. Under the old technology, you'll see in the New York Times Reporter had to chase Ellsberg all over the place to get him to release his materials. Under the digital age, Julian Assange did whatever he had to do to get Private Bradley Manning to release his materials. All right, so if they're in the same position, what does that do to the First Amendment? Well, is there any doubt that the First Amendment applies to the New York Times for publishing the WikiLeaks material? I would think there wouldn't be any doubt in anyone's mind whatsoever. If, in fact, the New York Times can publish the Pentagon Papers without legal problems, then it should be able to publish the WikiLeaks materials without legal problems. So, if the First Amendment applies to the New York Times, and Assange does exactly the same thing, the two results should be the same. Therefore, the First Amendment applies to each of them. Now, the question becomes, should the First Amendment apply to Julian Assange? I would submit that question is no different than asking the same question of the New York Times. Should the First Amendment apply to the New York Times for the publication of WikiLeaks material? The answer to that is, unsurprisingly, yes. And why is that important? The answer has to be yes. Because if the answer isn't yes, that means that all of you sitting in this room will not get the information to which you are entitled to make intelligent decisions about the government you elect. If we permit the government to come in and censor, that's what we're talking about. This is censorship. Now, Julian Assange's case is a little different, isn't it? Because censorship is before you publish. Assange has already published, okay? So we have censorship and then we have criminal publication. But I would like to suggest to all of you, we cannot tolerate criminal prosecution of those who publish in this country. We cannot tolerate it, whether it is the New York Times or whether it's Julian Assange. Now, keep your eyes out for what may happen in the next 2, 4, 6, whatever weeks. When you predict the future, you're always going to be embarrassed about what actually happened. But this is going, something is going to happen. Either all of this is going to go forward, which is to say, Assange goes back to Sweden and he comes to this country and he's indicted, and it happened before the election because one would say the legal process is required, or perhaps even Obama would like it. It's going to happen. Keep your eye on it. We can't tolerate it, as I said before. If it is allowed to go forward, you are the loser, not Julian Assange. So thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was James Good from the New York Times. I want to thank you on behalf of myself and my co-producer, Mickey Royce. I also want to mention one more thing on the ongoing story of Fukushima. The Japanese have shut down their last nuclear reactor. Reactor number 4 still has radioactive material in a pool on an unstable fourth floor. Many are regarding this as a greater threat to the world, not just to Japan, than anything else. Also, Helen Caldicott says that the material coming ashore in California, all up and down the West Coast, is increasingly radioactive from the Fukushima, and the fish should be tested. And also, again, I want to remind you, PDA, Progressive Democrats of America, are reaching out for help. So contact Mike Fox. That's Pinellas, pda@yahoo.com. I'm your host, Rick Spezak. I want to thank you for joining us once again. Stay tuned next week when we have some really fine guests. We've got Jose Suarez of One Miami, and we've also got Ellis Robinson from Ruthless in Florida. So tune in next week when we bring you more progressive activists from the great state of Florida and beyond. Ladies and gentlemen, it's our Constitution. It's our Bill of Rights, only if we insist. So I hope you join me. Thank you.